Why would John MacArthur say those who deny the resurrection provide the best evidence for it? And why do folks today still deny the resurrection? Find out as John looks at the resurrection cover-up on today's Grace to You. In a New York Times editorial, a former Harvard professor said this: "If God really exists and he wished to reveal himself to mankind, he would do so in a way that left no doubt." Well, if there's anything people doubt about God, it's that his son died, then rose again, and lives today. Why have folks gone to great lengths, beginning mere hours after the stone rolled away from Jesus' tomb, to dispute the resurrection? We'll consider that on today's Grace to You as John looks at the resurrection cover-up, what it involved, how it was carried out, and what the cover-up means for you if you're a Christian. Here's John MacArthur.
In spite of the evidence, through the years, sinners have endeavored to explain away the resurrection. It isn't that it is reasonable to explain it away. It is that they love their sin. And if Christ rose from the dead, then Christ is God, and they are guilty before God of their sin. Man, then, in an irrational effort to evade his guilt and accountability to God, concocts schemes to explain away the very evident resurrection. If you're not going to believe the resurrection, there's only one possible theory that makes any sense. Because the compelling issue in the resurrection is you have to explain the body being gone. And if it isn't resurrection, you only have one other option. Somebody took the body. That is the only reasonable explanation. So when all the critics and all the theories come down the pike, all you need to do is see if their theory explains the fact that the tomb is empty. Even the Jewish leaders knew that there was only one possible explanation apart from a resurrection, and that was somebody took the body. That's the only possible explanation. And so we could say then that there are people who have put forth that theory. In fact, that was the original theory. Look at Matthew 28, verse 11. "Now while they were on their way, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And when they had assembled with the elders and council together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, 'You are to say,'" and here's the only theory that makes sense, "'his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble.' And they took the money and did as they had been instructed, and this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day." In their effort to cover up the resurrection, they prove it to be true. And I'll show you that. Let's look at the plot. Verse 11. We'll pick it up a little bit a ways into verse 11. "Some of the guard came into the city." Now, who are these? These are some of the guard. There were probably 12 of them. They had been set to guard the tomb. Back in verse 2, it was the dawn of the first day of the week. A severe earthquake had occurred. Severe earthquake. "An angel of the Lord descended from heaven, came and rolled the stone away and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, his garment as white as snow, and the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men." There was an earthquake, and the stone was gone, and there was an angel from heaven, and the body is gone, and the grave clothes are there. And no doubt, those soldiers had been told by the Jews, be especially careful on the third day, because that's when he said he would rise. And they must have been very watchful as that third day dawned. And then it happened. So the chief priests now receive the word the first news of the resurrection of Jesus. The disciples don't even know yet. The women, indicated in verse 11, were still on their way to the disciples. The disciples didn't even know this yet. But now the leaders know. What was their reaction? Well, go back to chapter 27, verse 42 for a minute. When Jesus was hanging on the cross, the priests, chief priests, same people, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him. These are the religious leaders of Israel. They are so glad to see him on the cross. They despise him with such rancor that they're literally mocking him while he's dying. And they said, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. They mock. Let him now come down from the cross and we shall believe in him. That's what they said. If he'll come down, we'll believe. Well, let me tell you something, folks. He did something better than come down. He died there and came out of the grave, and they still didn't believe. They weren't about to believe. Their hearts were as hard as the stone that had been rolled away. They were confirmed in apostasy. And so when they hear that there was a resurrection, a supernatural resurrection, and all of the evidence is clear that it was a supernatural resurrection, and that what they feared had indeed come true, and they knew his power to raise other dead people because they'd seen it. They knew his power to heal diseases. They knew his power over the kingdom of darkness. They knew his ability to multiply food, to do miraculous wonders, to walk on water, etc. They knew all of that. Their greatest fear, therefore, simply is another in a long line of miracles they were very much aware of. But instead of those miracles bringing faith, they just hardened their resolute and sin-loving hearts. And so the shock of a resurrection catapulted them into a plot to cover it up. So in verse 12, when they had assembled with the elders and counseled together, that is a meeting, a formal meeting of the Sanhedrin took place. The Sanhedrin is 70 men, 70 of the elders of Israel who constitute the body of adjudication, the legal body that had the ability to make resolutions, to make laws with regard to the whole nation. And so they convened. The language here in the Greek is formal language. And the term they had assembled is a reference to the formal meeting of the Sanhedrin. And the words counseled together indicates an official resolution. They had taken counsel together or counseled together. That is a formal phrase indicating a formal passing of a resolution. So the ruling body, the Sanhedrin, came together. The facts were told to them that Jesus had risen from the dead, that an earthquake came, that an angel was there, blazing glory, causing all of the Roman guard to literally fall over in a dead faint, and that all of that was told to them firsthand by those guards. And now they've got to do something about it. So they assemble together and they come to a resolution. The resolution is threefold. Number one, we bribe the soldiers to lie. And it says, they gave at the end of verse 12 a large sum of money to the soldiers. We have to bribe them to lie. We can't have them going around saying there was an earthquake and the tomb was opened and there was a holy angel and the grave clothes were lying there and the napkin was in its place and obviously Jesus rose from the dead. We can't allow that. So they gave them a large sum of argyria, silver money. Judas, you know, they had bought for 30 pieces of silver. Now they had to pay probably 12 times that amount, but there was no price too high to lie about this. This they could not tolerate. Isn't that amazing? How resolute was their unbelief that to preserve their wicked, sinful position and their wicked hearts, they would literally fabricate a deception to cover up that act by which redemption had been purchased. The grave was empty. This is the only lie that works. Swoon theories don't work. Mental telepathy theories don't work. Seances don't work. Imposters don't work. Nothing works but this, because you have to explain an empty tomb. The Romans knew it was empty. The Jews knew it was empty. Everybody knew it was empty. Everybody in history now knows it was empty. It's always been empty. They had no choice. So they paid him a large sum of money. Verse 13, and they told him, "You are to say," you can't tell the truth, "you are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep." That's what you're to say. And so the soldiers are bribed to become preachers of the anti-gospel. Now, there's some implications for this. If you happen to be a Roman soldier and you're given a position to guard something and you go to sleep on the job, this is pretty serious. You could lose your commission. Worse, you could lose your what? Your life. What are they doing sleeping in violation of Roman military law? The death penalty would be prescribed for such an activity. So the first thing they do is they bribe the soldiers. The second thing they do is tell the soldiers to preach the lie. And the third thing they do is protect the soldiers. These are the leaders of Israel. They say, "You are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep." Is that true? It's not true. And they know it's not true. You see, that is the only possible theory. That's the only theory that makes any sense, because you have to explain the absent body. And you know the Jews didn't take the body. They wanted it left in there, and that's why they sealed it. The Romans didn't take it. They had no reason to take it. They know there's only one possible theory, and that is the disciples took it, and they know that's not what happened. So that there's only one possibility left. Jesus rose from the dead. This is brilliant. And the implications for the soldiers are going to go around saying, "Well, we were all asleep and the disciples came and stole his body." The question I have is, "Oh, really? If you were asleep, how do you know who stole his body?" You can't have both. You can't be asleep and also know who took him. I mean, the whole thing is absurd. The implications to the Romans are so serious that in verse 14 they say, "And if it comes to the governor's ears," that's Pilate, who is the chief military officer in Palestine, "if Pilate hears about this, we will win him over." Boy, were they good at doing that. They literally had Pilate in their hands like putty, because Pilate had done so many stupid things while he was trying to represent the Roman presence in Palestine to irritate and agitate the Jews, that the Jews had gone to Rome time after time complaining about Pilate. And eventually, of course, when Pilate was resistant in crucifying Jesus, the Jews said to him, "If you don't crucify Jesus, we will tell Caesar." And Pilate was so afraid of another complaint by the Jews to Caesar that he caved in under that blackmail. And they knew they had him right in the palm of their hand. He wasn't about to survive any other uprising of the Jews against him, and so they knew they could go to Pilate if Pilate was going to exercise some action against them, some court-martial or some execution, and they had Pilate in the palm of their hand, and they could keep the soldiers out of trouble. Well, this is becoming a pretty elaborate scheme. You got to tell the soldiers to lie. In order to get them to lie, you have to bribe them. You remember that John the Baptist, when he was preaching by the Jordan River, called soldiers to repentance, and he said, "If your repentance is real, you won't take any more bribes," indicating that that's what soldiers did. They could be bought, they could be bribed. And so they were bribed. And now they've got to also cover their backside from the standpoint of Pilate, so they might have to exercise a little of their intimidation and blackmail against Pilate to protect these men. So this is becoming a very elaborate scheme to cover up the simple reality of what the soldiers told them happened. Well, the soldiers, verse 15, took the money. They didn't care about Jesus. They didn't care about any of this messianic talk. It was of no interest to them. They just took the money and did as they had been taught, is the actual word, didasko. It's the classic Greek word for taught. I'm sure they were literally brought in. And you know, when you've got, let's say you've got 12 soldiers there, you've got 12 people who are going to be telling the same story, and they all know it's a lie, you got to go over the details, right? Because if people start comparing stories, "Well, soldier so-and-so told me it happened this way. Well, soldier so-and-so told me it happened this way." They must have concocted this thing down to the fine details, and there was a time of pedagogy going on where they sat these soldiers down and instructed them all in the details so everybody would get it right in case somebody started comparing notes. And you have the plot. And the propagation follows. Verse 15, they took the money and they did as they had been instructed. And this story was widely spread among the Jews. That they weren't told to keep this thing to themselves. They were told to spread it because they knew that the resurrection was going to be preached. They knew that because it had happened. And they were sure that the disciples would know. And the women had already known and were on the way to the disciples. They knew this thing was going to spread, so they had to spread the lie. So they literally went out propagating it, and it was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. Matthew's writing some 30 years later, and he's saying it is still the dominant story. So the soldiers who knew better lied. Chief priests who knew better lied. And they spread the lie. You know, this is... If you study the Gospels, if you study the Gospel of Matthew, study the life of Christ, from the beginning of the Gospel to the end of it, it's just a long litany of insults against the Son of God. There's just no end to this long line of insults until you get to this. This is the last great effrontery. This is the last great insult. This is the final note of rejection. Create a lie to cover up what you know is true. This is the final apostasy and is the reason why a few years later, Jerusalem is destroyed under the judgment of God. Maybe you're wondering in your mind, why would Matthew end like this? Why would he come to the end of his gospel like this? Isn't it a rather negative approach? I mean, we have such a glorious gospel. Isn't this kind of going in the back door on it? Well, admittedly, at first, it certainly appears to be negative, but the fact is it's not. It is divine genius to approach it like this. I'll tell you what he's doing. He could have proved the resurrection by the positive side. He could have talked about the empty tomb. He could have talked about the grave clothes lying there. He could have talked about the earthquake. Could have talked about the stone being moved. Could have talked about the angel. Left it at that. Or he could have talked about Mary Magdalene and given personal testimony from her. Could have given personal testimony from Peter or John. Could have given personal testimony like Luke did from the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. He could have gotten testimony from the 12 when they were gathered in the upper room on the Sunday night when Jesus appeared. He could have talked about the 12 when they were gathered together 8 days later and Jesus appeared again. He could have had Thomas give his testimony that he saw his hands and he saw his feet and he saw the hole in his side, and he said, "My Lord and my God." He could have given the testimony of the seven who saw him in Galilee, recorded in the last chapter of John's gospel. He could have given testimony from the 500 eyewitnesses. He could have given testimony from James. He could have given testimony from the 11 on the Mount of Olives who saw Jesus and saw him ascend into heaven. That is to say, he could have used the testimony of his friends. And that was good testimony. I mean, the disciples really did believe. They believed that Jesus was alive. They saw him. They talked with him. They touched him. They ate with him. Over a period of 40 days, they interacted with Jesus. This wasn't some momentary thing. They were convinced without a single shadow of doubt. After Thomas was brought in, they were absolutely convinced. They were so convinced they spent the rest of their life declaring that Jesus was alive, and they gave their lives, most of them, as martyrs for that reality. And they didn't believe that there would be a resurrection. Even the two on the road to Emmaus were moaning and worrying themselves with their sadness over the fact that Jesus was dead. And even Thomas wouldn't believe if he hadn't seen him. But they became powerful preachers of the resurrection. So powerful that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people responded immediately to their preaching. What power transformed them? What change these cowardly, simple, poor, illiterate preachers into men who can change the entire face of the earth. They weren't eloquent. They weren't educated. They weren't particularly brilliant. They weren't strong orators. They weren't masters of argument and logic and persuasion and charm. And they weren't about to die for a lie or an illusion. But they preached it not only preached it, but preached it with passion. Furthermore, they had every opportunity to satisfy themselves with the evidence. They saw Jesus, they touched Jesus, they talked with him, they ate with him. That's why Acts 1:3 says that he proved himself alive by many infallible proofs. Now, that's all very convincing. I mean, I could make an argument for the resurrection from his friends who really saw him. And it changed their life and they changed the world. But you know something? The world is always going to be full of critics who wouldn't believe his friends. Oh, they'd say it was an illusion. They've said it. Oh, they say it was a hallucination. Oh, it was some mental telepathy. Or they were just literally deceived by an imposter. Or, of course, they're going to lie about him. They were his friends, and they want to carry on the ruse because they loved him and he was nice to them. So there would be people who would dismiss the testimony of his friends. I'll tell you this, it's pretty hard to dismiss the testimony of his enemies. The last thing the Jewish leaders wanted was a resurrection, and they got one. And the whole cover-up is the strongest proof that it really happened. You see, just follow the thought. It was impossible for them to deny that Christ had by some supernatural means arisen. It was impossible to deny it. They couldn't deny it. So they only had one option. If you are going to deny what is impossible to deny, you have to come up with some explanation for the empty tomb. So they did. But it's absolutely absurd, and it is impossible to believe their explanation. How could or would cowardly disciples, the boldest of whom had denied Jesus three times, namely Peter, and all the rest had scattered when he was taken prisoner, how could all of them all of a sudden come together with great power, great resolution, great force, go in, overpower the Roman guard, and steal the body of Jesus, and then live a life to carry out that deception that led them to martyrdom? That is absolutely idiotic. And they wouldn't bribe the Roman soldiers. They didn't have anything with which to bribe them. And they didn't have any ability to protect them from Pilate. And if they did steal the body, why did they have all the grave clothes lying in there? Why didn't they just get in there, grab it as it was, and leave? And how did they move the stone? And how did they overpower the guards? And they didn't even believe in resurrection. And then there's that disturbing verse 13. The soldiers were supposed to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. What is that? How do you know that if you're asleep? There were four watches in the night for Roman soldiers. They lasted 2 to 3 hours each. Are we to believe that the whole guard fell asleep when they were routinely used to being awake for their watch? And then if they were asleep, they had nothing to report. But they reported all the details. They weren't asleep. They were awake. They saw it all. And the Jews covered it up. That's the greatest proof of the resurrection. Proof that comes from his enemies.
As a prominent theologian put it, I know of no fact in the history of mankind which is proved by better and fuller evidence than Christ's death and resurrection. And as for John MacArthur, what he just explained, perhaps the best evidence for the resurrection comes from Christ's enemies, those involved in covering it up. The title of John's lesson on today's Grace to You, The Resurrection Cover-Up. John, I know a lot more could be said about Jesus conquering death, so let me simply ask this question. What would you encourage listeners to focus on as they worship this Sunday?
Well, I guess the thing that comes to mind is, sort of like Christmas, the clutter that comes around what we call Resurrection Sunday. And we've started using that term. I've been using it for many, many years, just so I don't have to say Easter, because Easter is more related to a pagan goddess than it is to the Bible, and conjures up rabbits and eggs and frilly dresses and
little hats and all of that kind of thing. But when you talk about resurrection, you're talking about the heart and soul of the Christian gospel. You know, I was preaching recently on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and it was amazing to me as I tried to build the case for the critical, culminating, triumphant significance of the resurrection. People came to me and said, wow, you know, we all focus on the cross, we think about the cross, we look at the cross, we remember the cross in the communion service, we study the elements of the cross, the nuances of redemption, and sometimes we kind of think the cross is the pinnacle, but it isn't. The great, culminating, glorious miracle of the resurrection is the culmination of Christ's redemptive work. Celebrate that as you gather with God's people on Resurrection Sunday.
And friend, if today's lesson or John's study the past few days titled The Crucifixion Chronicle has encouraged you and prepared you to worship this weekend, do let us know about that fact. Encourage the staff here by sending a note. Even help us plan for future broadcasts with your feedback as you tell us how Grace to You is helping you. Get in touch today. Our mailing address is Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. Remember, you can also reach us through email. That address is letters@gty.org. Thanks for remembering that Grace to You is listener-funded. The same lesson you heard today and the lessons you hear every day are broadcast throughout America and globally, mainly because of the financial support we receive from listeners in the United States. So if you're benefiting from the Bible teaching we provide, consider supporting us with a tax-deductible donation. Write to Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412, or call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE. Now, if you'd like to own John's lesson today called The Resurrection Cover-Up, go to the Grace to You website, gty.org. Remember, you can order the CD there or download it free of charge in the MP3 format. In fact, all of John's 3,000 messages are available on MP3 free of charge online at gty.org. You can also watch Grace to You television, read daily devotionals, and download sermon transcripts all free online at gty.org. And now for John MacArthur, we thanks for tuning in today. Don't miss the Grace to You television program, seen Sundays on DirecTV Channel 378. And then join us here Monday as John continues unleashing God's truth one verse at a time on the next Grace to You. If you're a Christian, you've no doubt heard of the Beatitudes. Question is, what are they and why are they critical or crucial to finding true happiness? We'll find out next week here on Grace to You.